The MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome back to the MadTech Podcast. I'm Mariam, editorial lead here at ExchangeWire, and this week I'm very excited to be joined by two very special guests. First, we have Georgina Bramall, who is Marketing Strategy Director at GiftGaff. Georgina, thank you so much for being here.
You're welcome. Delighted to be here.
Yeah, really excited to get some of your insights into some of the topics. Also joining us is Matt Broughton, who is ExchangeWire's very own research lead. Matt, thank you for being here.
Not a problem at all, Mariam. It's great to be here. And yeah, looking really, really forward to the discussion today.
So we have a lot to talk about today. So I want to dive straight into our first news story, which is the IAB releases new guidelines as retail media networks mature. So the IAB has introduced new guidelines to improve measurement across retail media networks this week. The guidelines will be open for public comment through October 13th. The retail media sector has continued to grow and ad spend in the area is increasing, but the IAB have found that 62% of ad buyers have cited a lack of measurement standards as a top challenge for entry into retail media. So, Georgina, I'm really interested to get your thoughts on this, so we'll go to you first. Do you think advertisers will welcome these new guidelines? What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, great question. So I think, you know, they're definitely going to be welcomed. You know, lack of measurement and standardization, I think, really held advertisers back from adding, you know, this retail media opportunity to their plans. I think the ability to be able to kind of compare across networks and really measure the impact of campaigns using these retail media networks versus, you know, other channels on the plan, it's really necessary to bring that transparency so that we can almost understand that the investment is going to be worth it.
Right, definitely. Matt, what's your thoughts on
yeah,
that?
Yeah, I completely agree with Georgina there. I think it's, you know, addressing the measurement standards and adding that consistency will just have a really positive effect on the channel. And I think obviously these measurement guidelines are a bit more focused on the brand side, but it's so encouraging to see that privacy and security is one of the key areas focused on within those guidelines. We did some research at ExchangeWire earlier on in the year, which showed on the retailer side of things that, that concerns over that customer data was the leading barrier to entry for those retailers. Right. So the fact that this is being addressed in these guidelines is hugely positive to help that retailer buy-in, because it protects retail media as an emerging sector. You need to have the buy-in from the retailers because, you know, they can legitimately say, we're going to take our football and go home if it's not going to be worth it for, you know, in terms of those concerns regarding the customer data.
Right. And it like you said, it's very interesting. I mean, this is a massive space. I think it was something like $40 billion worth. So, Matt, what are your thoughts on, do you think retail media can reach its seemingly massive potential? What are your thoughts on that?
There's definitely a wealth of untapped potential in the sector for, you know, obviously brands and the retail as well. And I find that the notion that it's an Amazon-only game, as you know, some commentators have suggested, I think that's absolute nonsense. I think you've got the rise of, you know, the vertical specialists, the more sort of regional specialists. And I think what, you know, in terms of recent weeks with the stories with Indonesia banning social commerce, for example, on the TikTok platform, that gives opportunity to, you know, the more regional or national participants to really carve out their niche within retail media. However, like I said, it does need to be treated quite delicately. And I think the key thing there is that user retailer advertiser value exchange. Obviously, customers are much more likely and much happier to, you know, give their data and share their data if it's in return for, say, you know, loyalty card points, rather than, you know, if you log on to, you know, one of the more, you know, less reputable websites and get bombarded with ads. It's not necessarily going to preserve that user experience, and it's not going to be as good for the user. And obviously in a retail environment, if the user's not happy with that, it means they're more likely to shop elsewhere. So yeah, I think, yeah, preserving and treating that user value exchange very delicately, I think that's the main way in which retail media can achieve its potential.
Yeah, definitely. George, what's your thoughts on that? Do you think retail media can reach its seemingly massive potential, or do you think there's some barriers there?
I mean, look, from a marketeer's perspective, I think it's just incredibly logical that as a brand, you'd want to get closer to that kind of customer journey. And so I think being present in those locations where you can be closer to your target audience, where you can use that retailer's first party data to be more effective in terms of your messaging or more effective in terms of your targeting, you know, particularly in the context of things like the depreciation of the cookie and some of the challenges that marketeers face in terms of reaching their audiences, I think this sort of potential to offer a level of personalization and connection again with that audience, you know, done in the right way, could really unlock something here. So yeah, I do think there is that opportunity for retail media to grow significantly and to become a much more usual part of a marketeer's plan. Whereas at the moment, I think it still feels a little bit nascent in terms of how people might be using it.
Right. So I'm interested to get your guys' thoughts on our next story here. So I'm just going to jump straight into that. So UK broadcasters have announced Freely, which is going to be a joint CTV service. So public sector broadcasters in the UK are gearing up to launch a new digital service to challenge streaming. The joint service, which will be called Freely, is specifically designed for smart TVs and will carry free IP-delivered streams of the participating broadcasters' channels, as well as on-demand content. I mean, this is going to have some big names in it. So we have BBC, ITV, and Channel 4, who are amongst the broadcasters who have developed this new platform, which will enable the delivery of live TV over broadband. So Matt, I want to go to you here. I'm interested to know what you think. Do you think Freely will make an impact on how consumers adopt CTV?
I think it's 100% the right call for the public service broadcasters to club together and come together with a solution for IP delivered streaming, because obviously the market does, 15% already in that part of the market. So it's only right that they should be looking towards that and coming up with a solution for that. However, I do have a number of questions as to how Freely will be incorporated into that TV experience. Will it just be kind of folded into existing kind of TV guides? In which case there's going to be, if the TV manufacturers have made their own TV guide services, how will that fit in, especially with UK legislation mandating that public service broadcasters are given due prominence? And if it's a standalone app, on the flip side, that experience, it feels a little bit clunky. And it gives that fragmentation that I think the public service broadcasters will be looking to avoid. And I can just imagine the calls with less tech savvy relatives. Where's the channels? I want to watch Poirot. It's on Freely. Free what? Freely. It's on BBC. I've got BBC Three. No, it's Freely. I think there's questions to be asked there. And I think also there's questions about how the data will be collected and managed. That will also be interesting. Will, for example, the BBC get insight into the performance of ITV shows and those of other public service, non-public service broadcasters that may potentially join the platform? I think there will be an impact, but there's a lot of questions at the moment, which I'm sure will be answered. It's very interesting to see how it will evolve going forward.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's some big names behind this, BBC, ITV. So it's not like they can really afford to fail. But like you said, there are many questions to be asked about this. George, what are your thoughts on that? Do you think that this will make an impact on how consumers adopt CTV?
I do think it will make an impact. I mean, I think to build on Matt's point, also encountering elderly relatives, navigating through what is actually a very fragmented, space when you think of the amount of apps, channels, various things that, consumers can use to actually access content. This could feel like yet another platform to get your head around. And I think, also to sort of build on Matt's point a little bit, it is a clunky experience right now. So, effectively the journey sort of pings you out actually into those individual broadcasters, streaming apps. So it's not sort of, you don't really feel like you're part of that Freely ecosystem. So I'm imagining that this is obviously a very first pass attempt at this and that things will continue to improve. But at the moment, I think there's the potential of it being slightly more confusing from a user journey perspective. And therefore, whether that will bring that mass adoption that presumably coming together as a group of broadcasters, which I think is pretty unheard of in terms of kind of, dropping some of those different station dilemmas between each other and really coming together for a greater good, potentially. It'd be interesting to see how quickly that sort of more nascent sort of user experience sort of transitions to enable more users to actually get on board in a sort of more easy to use way, I think.
Yeah, I think that's a sort of good segue into my next question. So on the topic of elderly relatives, do you think that this was purposely done in the sense of, do you think this could be a gateway or the answer to getting a generation to stick with linear TV? George, I'll stick with you there. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, that must have been within the thinking as obviously the sort of more traditional TV platforms came together to build the service. And, you know, the ease with which now consumers can, you know, purchase a TV that has everything integrated within it. I think, you know, clearly the idea is to get rid of some of those barriers and help people make that transition from those more traditional platforms. I think what might be interesting is also the content available on there. So, you know, clearly there are some, I mean, Poirot, one of them, some headline programs that people might be massively interested in, but also, you know, how those broadcasters might come together with more original content on those platforms, for example, and whether that also provides an opportunity to help people move potentially from that more standard linear platform construct into more of a CTV way of accessing entertainment, information, etc.
Yeah, it's really, I never even thought about that. They might have like freely originals, just like Netflix sort of has. Yeah, that'd be interesting. Matt, what's your thought on that? Do you think this could be a gateway to sort of appealing to the younger generation?
Yeah, I think, again, it, you know, it depends on that user experience. And I think it also speaks to that, you know, argument that's been bandied around over the last few years. Is CTV, or at least will CTV in the coming years, will that just be considered TV? If it's just a case of it's the exact same user experience, just it's being delivered over IP rather than through, you know, the traditional television aerials, then, you know, what's the difference there? I also am amused by the notion that freely is kind of serving as a gateway drug. One moment they're watching Bargain Hunt and the next they're horrified at the latest criminal show on Netflix. But yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see how it evolves going forward. But I'd also like to reference a story earlier in the week, that streaming giants in the US, they're clubbing together on their side of things, essentially to lobby the US government over legislation that may, you know, either bring, you know, traditional broadcasters, you know, reduce some of the restrictions they have or impose some of the similar restrictions on them. And yeah, that'd be interesting to see how that one evolves going forward. And again, I'm entertained by the notion that, you know, these global corporate giants are clubbing together to fight the existential threats of homes under the hammer and can't pay, we'll take it away. But I think it shows that the approach, you know, the European market is taking to regulate streamers is working. And I think the rules that the UK are bringing out to give public service broadcasters a bit more of a nudge up, in the sense that they're under restrictions, and yet Netflix, Amazon Prime, etc., they're able to, you know, make creative content, not under the same level of restrictions. So I think that kind of leveling of the playing field can only be a good thing.
Yeah, definitely something to keep an eye on. Really interesting to see how that will play out. So just getting to our last news story here. And one that I think will be really interesting to see play out. So prominent authors are suing OpenAI. Some of the world's most prominent authors, this includes Jonathan Franzen, George R.R. Martin, and Jody Picoult, have sued OpenAI, alleging that ChatGPT has been trained on their works. There have been a series of legal actions against the owners of generative AI tools, which have hit the mainstream this year, and as they see wide adoption as creative tools. So, Matt, going to you here. Does generative AI require closer regulation? What do you think about that? Do you think that there are some rules that need to be changed when it comes to safeguarding intellectual property?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, the kind of mechanism for that will be quite traditional. I think there'll be some, you know, the precedents will be set with the ongoing legal cases, for example, this one, and also the Getty Images versus Stability AI case. Then I think governments will step in with legislation after the usual hefty levels of debate. But I think, you know, generative AI, it's going to lead to whole scale changes in copyright law, because it's just not necessarily, you know, adapted for the massive power of these platforms. You know, GPT-4, the latest model, it's apparently got, you know, as many as 1.7 trillion different parameters. And there's been allegations, obviously, within this lawsuit and separate ones within the writing community, that it's been trained on, you know, pirated material, massive databases of books. And yeah, it's not a good good look for the generative AI platforms, but it's interesting to see how it will be legislated. And I'm very interested to see how pliable those models are. Is it, you know, possible to reverse engineer the sources where, you know, a particular output has come from? If the generative AI, you know, firms lose their legal battles, are they able to remove specific sources from, you know, this massive database of 1 trillion sources, for example? And yeah, if it's, for example, you know, say data about Game of Thrones, particular quotes from Game of Thrones was, you know, gleaned from Wikipedia, for example, across multiple different pages, would they be able to remove that rather than, you know, a more clear cut example? If it was a particular, you know, pirated version that was scraped, they could just axe that. But it's, if it's over multiple different pages, then I assume that would be a more difficult process. So yeah, there's a lot of technical challenges there, but yeah, it definitely needs closer regulation. And I think it needs it soon, given, you know, the cat's already out of the bag in terms of how much, you know, material has already been used and potentially used to create things that would have otherwise violated copyright.
Yeah, interesting stuff. George, what's your thoughts there? Do you think that AI requires closer regulation?
I think I'd echo a lot of sort of what Matt said there. I mean, IP is quite a complex topic in itself, and throwing sort of AI on top of it just really kind of deepens that further. So, you know, I suspect we're probably just at the start of seeing claims like this surface, not only from what models are trained on, but also I think maybe interestingly what the models generate and who potentially owns the IP around that. So, you know, if I create an artwork, if I create a piece of work, do I own it? Who owns it? So I think that sort of regulation is that next sort of logical step to really try and provide a bit of clarity, you know, between that intersection of where AI generation and intellectual property rights in its broadest sense sort of exist. And I definitely sort of welcome steps around that. It's quite interesting to see the prominent cases, as Matt sort of touched on there. But I think there'll be more nuance to those cases, and we'll need to think about a regulatory framework that really helps unpack and manage each of those areas.
Definitely. So it's interesting because we've obviously found ourselves at a crossroad of technological advancement and also creative copyright. So Matt, I wanted to ask you, do you think brands could find themselves in hot water through the making of these tools? What sort of ethical questions are we looking at here?
I think it depends on what they're used for. And I know, you know, in terms of the Writers Guild strike that's just been resolved, I believe in terms of if a work has been made fully using AI, for example, then that in itself cannot be copyrighted, which may itself give protections on that. But I think in terms of how, you know, brands would use generative AI, I think using generative tools to, you know, for example, dynamically update your own creative, for example, translating to a different language, or, you know, adding in a particular, you know, thing that would help it resonate better with a particular audience, I think that's a positive use case. And I think that could, you know, revolutionize advertising. But on the flip side, if you're going to use it less beneficially, for example, you know, slashing your own creative teams in favor of getting ChatGPT to rustle up an idea for a particular slogan, tagline, image, whatever, and then only to discover later, actually, this is very, very similar or indeed wholly based upon a copyrighted piece of work, then that's a obviously less positive use case. So yeah, it depends on how you use AI. I think there are so many benefits, so many advantages that it can potentially bring to the advertising ecosystem. But yeah, it cannot be used just lazily to try and, you know, slash those creative teams or remove processes that should not be removed at all.
Definitely. George, what's your thoughts there? Do you think there's ethical questions that are raised, and what do you think those ethical questions are?
I think there'll always be ethical questions. You know, whenever any new technology comes around, there's, you know, different ways for brands to really think about using it. And I think it will come down to each use case. You know, I think as Matt talked through, that we could see some quite significant use cases where, you know, human endeavor, human effort is written off. But actually, I think on the positive side, we could see many positive use cases where human endeavor is amplified. So, you know, coding, for example, removing the need for sort of heavy level engineers, coders, to be sort of focused on the more day-to-day coding, running of platforms, automating that through an AI process, allowing them more time to sort of spend and invest on, you know, higher level items that are going to really change user experience or really improve the code base, et cetera. So I think it's really going to depend how brands see those individual use cases within their own operating models. And I think the governance internally is quite interesting as well. So how those brands think about those use cases. So of course, there'll be, I would imagine, some legislative frameworks coming out from an external perspective, but how they're interpreted, you know, to fit the culture of the brand, to fit the ethos of the brand, and how they want to sort of be seen in that consumer's sort of eyesight, I think is also going to be quite interesting.
Definitely. It raises a lot of interesting questions there. So I want to move on to part two of today's podcast episode. And so for part two, Georgina, we want to put the spotlight back on you for a bit and let our listeners get to know you a little bit and what you're working on at GiftGaff. So sustainability is a key topic for us in the industry at the moment. I mean, it's one of the buzzwords that we're hearing right now, and that's something that's close to your heart. Can you tell us something a little bit more about what you're working on in that area?
Yeah, of course. No worries. So yeah, you're right. Sustainability is a topic very close to my heart. So at GiftGaff, we're actually a B Corp. So we achieved our B Corp certification in April of this year. And I think the most significant thing about that certification is that we change our legal articles of association. So that means that we balance people, planet, and profit equally. So we had to obviously talk to all of our shareholders around moving from a more traditional financial profit-based model into a more balanced model. So that's super exciting. And of course, therefore, my focus is around how do we move that forward over the next 3 years. And I think specifically within the context of marketing, there's a lot of work that we can do around sort of the ad industry, the marketing industry, media industry. And really, my current focus is around sort of decarbonization, which is obviously just one facet of sort of sustainability. But, you know, similarly to what we talked about in the kind of legislative sections above, what we're missing as an industry, I think, is a unified measurement framework. So, you know, there are 37 carbon calculators out there. Everybody's sort of popping their media plans through them, and they're all sort of spitting out different answers. So that need for real standardization, and actually for the industry to come together and really align behind one carbon calculator, is something that I'm really passionate about and sort of lobbying with the various industry bodies to try and get more progress around that. So that's taking up quite a lot of my time at the moment.
So you mentioned the balance of profit and planet, and I'm sure no matter what industry it is, you know, this cuts across all, not just the ad tech industry. How important is it to navigate the balance, and how can the two coexist, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think you've got to the real nub of the challenge. It's a tricky one, but I think it's just around changing the sort of mindset of how you sort of frame these challenges. And I think it's getting beyond the stereotype that sort of making a planet friendly choice is somehow going to be bad for the business. Actually, it's kind of really thinking about what is that intersection of planet and profit, and how can you create a proposition that sort of fits within both of those pillars. So if I give an example from a GiftGaff perspective, we tend to talk a lot around kind of value and values. So how are we providing this great product that's, you know, attractive to our members, it's got the right value, but equally, how is it also reinforcing that they've not had to make a compromise in their value set in order to buy that product from us? So a good example of that is sort of selling refurbished phones. So approximately 75-76% of our handsets that we sell are all refurbished. So it's good for the pocket, but it's also really good for the planet. And we really just need to focus on how do we find more of these propositions that sort of bring both of those notions together so they can be profitable for a business. We can grow share, we can add growth to the bottom line. But from a consumer's perspective, also great for them, a brilliant product that does the job at a price that they want to pay. And then I guess from a planet perspective, you know, we're not, you know, pulling new minerals out of the earth. We're using a handset and we're refurbishing that handset so that it has a different life for another consumer. So there's lots of ways I think that businesses can come together and really think about that intersection. It's just putting a slightly different mindset on that sort of proposition development journey.
Definitely. Some really interesting things that you're talking about there, George. Really excited to see how that plays out for you. Unfortunately, that's all the time that we have for today's episode. I just wanted to extend a big thank you, George, for joining us on today's episode. So thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Matt, thank you. Pleasure as always.
It's been an absolute pleasure, Mariam. And yeah, really, really interesting discussion.
So just before we close off for today's episode, I wanted to give ExchangeWise Industry Review a mention here. So all the sort of topics that we talked about today, sustainability, CTV, and a lot more are being covered within ExchangeWise Industry Review. If you want to find out how you can get involved in our industry review, please visit our website. And yeah, thanks for tuning in. That was this week's MadTech podcast episode.